The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
What is the point of finding these statutes that broadly criminalize regulatory violations and then ticking through all the regs? I just find it remarkable how granular the conduct can be that is essentially accidentally getting made criminal, right? And some of the things that regulators have apparently, potentially due to an incident, potentially due to just their distrust of humankind in general, but how granular they've had to get. I mean, they've had to tell us that you can't sell grated cream cheese. I think the fact that somebody somewhere here in Washington said, we got to put an end to all those people grating cream cheese out there.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, June 29th, 2019. We don't usually do humor on the Lawfare Podcast. We're a lot of things, but we're not usually funny. But this week, we're hamming it up. You probably know Mike Chase if you're on Twitter as @CrimeADay, the longtime anonymous Twitter feed that tweets out one fact pattern a day that violates some combination of the criminal law and the Code of Federal Regulations. Now, Mike has outed himself. His name is Mike Chase, and he has a new book called, appropriately enough, How to Become a Federal Criminal, an illustrated handbook for the aspiring offender. It's pretty frickin' funny, and it's got a lot of wacky laws, it's got a lot of wacky fact patterns, and Mike stopped by the Jungle Studio the other day to chat about it, to chat about the Twitter feed, and to chat about all those national security crimes you never knew you were violating. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 430, @CrimeADay, teaches you how to become a federal criminal. All right, let's start with your name. Is crime the first name and a day the last name, or is a middle initial?
Yeah, it's like a middle initial, but it's not stands for anything. It's just A. So the middle initial is A.
So it's like Harry S. Truman.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Most of what I've done has been modeled after Harry S. Truman.
I see.
Yeah.
And who are you really?
I'm really Mike Chase, but don't tell anybody. This is just between me, you, and I guess the microphone.
Yeah,
right?
And 40,000 people who download it. All right. So for those of you who don't know Mike Chase, you may know him on Twitter as @CrimeADay. Before we get to the book, just tell us a little bit of history of the – I mean, you outed yourself recently, I assume because you had a book coming out.
Right.
But how did the Twitter feed get started, and what's the story behind an anonymous lawyer in Connecticut secretly tweeting – furtively tweeting a single outrageous criminal offense every day?
Man, my criminal procedure professor would be so happy that we referred to my activities as furtive. So essentially, I started this thing in 2014. It was July. So we're coming up right now on the five-year anniversary. And the idea was, part of it was I had been digging around in the statutes and I found the Woodsy Owl statute, which just struck me as so bizarre that it was even possible that it was a federal crime to misuse the Woodsy Owl cartoon character.
Along with the Swiss coat of arms and the and the Smokey the Bear logo. Right,
which is just the Swiss coat of arms is just a white plus or a red cross. But in any event, the whole impetus for it was I said, okay, there's a couple of weird statutes, but maybe there's, a dozen or two dozen. And then I came across this notion that, you know, Professor John Coffey had said existed, which was that there may be as many as 300,000 criminally enforceable regulations. And there had been various competing theories about whether this was a myth, whether this was real or this was not. And I learned that the Department of Justice had actually staffed a project for 2 years to try and count all just the statutes that were criminally enforceable under federal law. So I said, well, I don't have a lot of time. I've got a busy white-collar practice. But if I do one a day, if there really are 300,000, that should only take like 800 years. So I'll just start now and I'll finish in 2848 and be good.
And so you have been doing – has Crime A Day missed a day since then?
I've never missed a day. And in fact, I didn't even miss the day that my son was born in the hospital, much to my wife's chagrin. But I was tweeting from the hospital, and I think it was probably a cheese crime because those are my go-tos in times of stress. So if you see me tweeting about like Swiss cheese, it's because I've had a very busy day.
Right. And you've never repeated a crime.
That's right. That's right. And part of the issue is if you look at the statutes, a lot of times there's all these infinitive verbs. And so one statute could potentially have six or a dozen crimes nestled within it because occasionally an attempt is its own crime under a statute. So sometimes you'll see similar prohibited conduct addressed, but I've never repeated a crime.
All right. So what is, you know, you're the person who knows probably the most of anybody in the world about ways to accidentally trip over a criminal law. So, you know, what's the last crime you think I'm likely to have committed?
So I think that it's very common for people to deposit mailable matter, unstamped mailable matter into post office boxes, their neighbors' post office boxes or however they do it. I think a lot of people do that. I think if you've been walking –
You mean so like if you put a gift for your neighbor – In their mailbox,
right.
You're not talking about throwing eggs in a post office blue box,
right? I think that's probably a separate matter. That's potentially injury to postal property, which
I
is a different.
Because I confess, as a younger person, that was something I cannot confirm or deny that I ever would have done.
Is it longer ago than 5 years?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you're totally good.
All right. Yeah,
I've done you're it. In great shape. Statutes run on that. So you can confess as much as you want. But it's true. I mean, you know, there are postal statutes are a great example, right? And so, yeah, if you injure postal property, if you go to the post office drunk and who knows what the standard is under the influence of alcohol. So you have a couple of glasses of wine and then you decide that you got to go, I don't know, send off some proofs of purchases from your cereal box. So
see,
you can
I
get
use stamps.com so I don't go to the post office.
Yeah, that's smart.
So that's how I save myself from crimes.
No, that's a very smart move because postal jurisdiction is all-encompassing and you're saving yourself a lot of potentially accidental crimes. But postal jurisdiction, federal property, if you move a table on public land, it doesn't specify how far you have to move the table, but that's enough.
All right, so the last Twitter feed – we had as a guest on the Lawfare podcast was very early in the history of the podcast. I had at Drunken Predator on the podcast to talk about human misconceptions of unmanned aerial vehicles. But we did not identify who at Drunken Predator really is. You're now out. How has at Crime A Day changed since it has the name Mike Chase associated with it?
So the big difference when you come out, when you're the shadow figure behind a popular Twitter feed is that it used to be people would say incredibly vile things to me. But now they say Mike, comma, and then they say a really
vile thing to me.
Yeah.
Welcome to my life.
Exactly right. So I think that's the main difference, how my life has changed. And the other very interesting thing is since How to Become a Federal Criminal came out, I didn't anticipate that there would ever be fan mail. I thought, no way. And but at my office
– people from prisons all over the country are writing to you now.
Well, there is that. There is some of that. And since they're all prospective clients, I won't disclose the substance of those communications. But what I will say is somebody mailed me the tags from their mattress that they cut off because my book liberated them to realize they weren't a criminal.
Well, it opens with that,
right?
With it is actually okay if you're the end user to cut off the tags on a mattress. Who is it not okay if you're – who else are you actually risking prison for the mattress – tag thing.
Yeah, these unscrupulous mattress dealers who are out there removing tags. I mean, the notion is that you're supposed to disclose what the fill is on these mattresses to make sure that they're not reusing fill or they're using something that's, you know, potentially hazardous to the user. But if you're going to own that mattress, if it's your forever mattress, right, and it's never going to leave your house, then you can cut it off. But I don't know. I mean, as a technical matter, what if you're only going to use the mattress for a year and then sell it off to somebody? Then who is the end user? I don't know. It gets very perilous.
And if you put it on eBay that you're selling your mattress, is eBay protected by CDA 230? and you bear the full responsibility, or is there a contra, you know?
That issue has not been resolved by the higher courts yet. So I think you're going to have to lose at trial to find out.
I actually think eBay is not protected for criminal liability, but they are protected for any civil liability.
So they're going to have to cut off the mattress trade because they can't verify that they're in compliance.
All right. Let's talk about the book. The field of federal criminal law humor, it's small, right?
Yeah.
It's not like there's, you know, you're standing on the shoulders of giants here. who are your like comic inspirations for real law made funny?
Oh, well, so I don't know about real law made funny. I mean, you know, there's been periodic folks over the years that have written pretty hilarious amicus briefs that have been submitted to the Supreme Court, which are obviously an influence. But for the most part, they use their prose and not the laws themselves. So,
I mean, when you look at Title 18, let alone, you know, the Code of Federal Regulations, comedy is not what springs to mind.
Oh, no? Oh, see, I disagree. Title 18 is actually sort of beautiful the way that it's divided up, especially when you get into stowaways and privateers.
Wait,
and
you got to hold that stuff.
All right.
We're going to save the national security stuff.
Sure.
We got to ease into that.
This is just the first date. You can't go right to privateers.
Exactly.
You know?
Let's talk about the methodology of the book, which is also the methodology of the Twitter feed itself.
Mm-hmm.
Most people, when they want to make fun of the federal criminal code, they find the Smokey the Bear law, they find the Swiss coat of arms law and the Woodsy Owl law, as well as a few isolated discrete statutes that are amusing on their own terms and often have a particular history associated with them. And they say, hey, look what I found, right? You take that to a certain additional degree. You add a step, which is you imagine you take the laws that make regs criminally enforceable, and then you imagine the most outrageous scenario you can that would be an undoubted defiance or noncompliance with the reg. And then you create, between the combination of the statute and the reg and the fact pattern, a crime.
Right. Right. And generally, I don't import facts that are outside of the letter of the reg or the statute themselves. So a lot of times I get granular based on really the available verbs, nouns, and subjects that are in those regs. Now, occasionally there's a current event in which I'm clearly commenting on some current event.
Although you only have done that recently.
Yeah, that's true. I mean,
that's kind of like a new, like, you know, more in your face crime a day, right?
Yeah.
Topical social commentary crime a day.
Well, I don't know if you've noticed. I've been paying attention to this, and it seems like federal crime is in the news like a lot lately. Like,
yeah.
People seem to be talking. I don't know.
It's a good time to be doing comedy about federal criminal law.
Yeah, my shtick is going to wrap up eventually, but I'm doing it now. No, you're right. I mean, it's the commentary there, that's an additional layer, which is, of course, I shouldn't be able to do what I do necessarily, which is no matter what's in the news, I can find some prohibitory clause somewhere in the federal law that arguably addresses the conduct. And back to your sort of an original question, which is, so what is the point of finding these statutes that broadly criminalize regulatory violations and then ticking through all the regs? I just find it remarkable how granular the conduct can be that is essentially accidentally getting made criminal, right? And some of the things that regulators have apparently potentially due to an incident, potentially due to just their distrust of the, you know, humankind in general. But how granular they've had to get. I mean, they've had to tell us that you can't sell grated cream cheese. I think the fact that somebody somewhere here in Washington said, we got to put an end to all those people grating cream cheese out there. The truth is, I think that grated cream cheese probably looks an awful lot like the cheese that, you know, went into the grater. And I don't think anybody's necessarily getting hurt. But what they were doing was specifying a definition of grated cheese, right? It's certain kinds of cheese. As a technical matter, under the Food and Drug Act, you technically have a crime there if you sell grated cream cheese. And so I just find the granularity of it so amusing.
All right. So I want to push you on that, though, because one thing that somebody could say and is, all right, you're being fantastical, mm-hmm. right? And you acknowledge this, that the thing that actually limits this is prosecutorial discretion. Mm-hmm. And by and large, prosecutors aren't going after the people who grate cream cheese, whatever that means, by the way.
Exactly right.
It's actually hard to visualize.
Yes, it is. But I do draw it in the book.
No, it's a good drawing. it's a good attempt at a visualization, but I still think it would just be mush. By and large, the thing that disciplines what you're describing is sanity mm-hmm. on the part of federal prosecutors, and that actually the regulatory violations have other means of enforcement or non-enforcement. And, you know, this stuff never shows up as criminal law, even though in some sort of loose technical sense it probably could, or in some specific technical sense it probably could. So my question is, are you cheating? You know, are you basically taking a criminal code that would never be applied this way and a regulatory code that, yeah, it has some sort of technical criminal applications, but it is generally not applied that way. And you're sort of manufacturing crimes that nobody would ever dream about in a fashion that's funny, but isn't actually descriptive of life in the United States. Or are there a lot of people actually being prosecuted for crazy, nutty stuff?
No, it's great that you asked that question, because that it's good to have an opportunity to talk about it. People get so caught up in sort of the humor of it that oftentimes you don't get to have that conversation about things. And just to back up for a minute, when you suggested that I might be being fantastical, thank you for saying that. You didn't have to say that. That's really, you know, nice to be called fantastical. But the truth is, I think there are three main.
18 U.S.C. 2389. And 28 CFR 47 forbids the use of the word fantastical on a podcast in a room with padded walls and one plant.
Well,
and since there's no plant in this room, despite it being called the Jungle Studio, you're in the clear. There's no criminal.
I also think prosecutors can be trusted to exercise discretion on that one too.
Podcasting crimes are very seldom actually brought.
It's true. And also, I think getting indicted for something like that would be the best possible promotion for my book there would be. So
indict Mike, hashtag.
Let's think about that. but the truth is that I think when you get down to the core of it, am I cheating? I don't necessarily think so. When certainly a core part of the objective is let's look at sort of what's regulated, right? So yeah, is there a criminal sanction attached to it or not? That's important. But let's look at just what the federal government has regulated and how granular that conduct has gotten. Fine. This is more principled than practical, right? Which is, there is a criminal sanction accidentally attached to conduct. And I agree that prosecutors are, for the most part, good faith actors. They can be expected to not waste their time or waste space on the docket bringing the kinds of silly cases that I imagine on Crime A Day. At the same time, I think that Congress should be a little more careful in doling out the criminal sanction than it has been. Right. And this isn't just a pure sort of fundamentalist anti, you know, non-delegation doctrine type argument. It's that I think that, you know, Herbert Packer, he wrote this great book called The Limits of the Criminal Sanction. And if you go through it, it's from 1968. But he's touching on issues that we're still hearing about every day now, which is, what is the purpose of the criminal sanction? How awesome is the power of the government to be able to deprive you of your liberty, to be able to investigate you, subpoena you, all those kinds of things, convene a grand jury and indict somebody. And so from my perspective, when I say it's more principled than practical, I just believe in the core that the criminal sanction should not be doled out carelessly or accidentally. And so let's imagine all the kinds of things that have potentially been made crimes. Then there is this additional component, which is simply, is this thesis true that there's over-federalization of criminal law? Is this thesis even true that there are all of these criminal regulatory provisions? So far, I don't know. I don't think I'm feasibly ever going to be able to get to a hand count of every regulation. We know how much the code changes, how fast it changes, how easily it changes in the Federal Register. But at the end of the day, perhaps Congress should exercise a bit more care in attaching the criminal sanction to conduct, and maybe criminal statutes shouldn't simply say, hey, whatever a regulatory agency says is prohibited is a crime, and then even further, sub-regulatory guidance or perhaps a parks, you know, superintendent then issues a document that is not checked by any check and balance, then becomes a criminal provision. I think that that's ludicrous, but that's also sort of the point that I'm making.
And how often do I have the impression, just from having watched federal criminal dockets for the last 25 years reasonably closely in some jurisdictions anyway, that a relatively small number of criminal statutes account for a wildly disproportionate number of criminal and percentage of criminal indictments, at least in the federal system, that if you lop off the top 50 statutes, you've accounted for some enormous percentage of all federal criminal dockets. First of all, do you agree with that? And secondly, if we're talking about these are end of the bell curve offenses, you know, right?
Oh, yeah.
When you get to the dead bees and stuff.
Right.
You know, how often do you see actual prosecutions of these sort of outliers of the interpretations of regulations made criminally enforceable through some, you know, general provision that leads to these absurdities? Are we talking mostly hypothetical, or do the cases actually show up?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I would say when you say the top 50 statutes, I would say
top 20.
It's probably in that ballpark, because if you look at the data, there are gun crimes, drug crimes, immigration crimes, and fraud crimes.
Right.
That's essentially the entire federal docket.
On lawfare material support.
No, sure. Right.
And of course, conspiracy and add conspiracy to do all of the things that you just described.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, the overwhelming majority of people that are going to be in the federal docket are committing a drug distribution offense. There's a gun involved, things like that, or somebody's committing bank fraud, wire fraud, things like that. And so they do account, no question, for the lion's share of cases on the federal docket. Now, the latest justice statistics indicate that in terms of administrative offenses, right? So people that have been prosecuted for offenses that are just based on regulations, regulatory violations, that it's probably in the ballpark of 1.5 to 2% of the criminal docket. So that's small, right? Proportionally, it's small. When you consider the number of people that pass through the criminal courts, of course, you know, each year, it's probably going to range from, you know, a few hundred to maybe as many as a couple of thousand people that are prosecuted for these offenses. And so in the main, they're going to be food crimes for the most part, maybe adulterated food, misbranded food, things along those lines. And so, yeah, in the grand scheme of things, say we did eliminate all of these regulatory offenses, it probably wouldn't make a substantial dent in federal criminal dockets, probably at all. But when we know that 90% of people plead guilty when they're charged, there is still some number of people who are charged with these administrative offenses who are going to walk away with a criminal record, a permanent federal criminal record, because they exist. Now, certainly the more ridiculous crimes, right? How many people get prosecuted for mislabeled boxes of dead bees getting mailed into the United States? Low number, although the New York Times just reported about a guy in Connecticut who was prosecuted for importing singing finches and hair curlers, and apparently he's the fourth guy in the last couple of months to have done it.
Well, there's a memo, you know, Justice Department priorities include that now. It's the singing finches. It's Barr got into office and, you know, wrote the singing finches memo.
But part of it is also an odd curiosity about the world itself for me, in that I'm actually pretty agnostic about most regulations. I'm not one of these people who believes regulation is inherently good or inherently bad.
So it's not a sort of libertarian instinct behind this.
It could be in some regard, in that I don't really think that you should be careless about wielding what I think is the most awesome power the government has, which is to potentially deprive somebody of their liberty and forever brand them a criminal. So in that sense, you could say that it's a libertarian impetus, because I do believe that that's one of the most awesome powers that exists, and it deserves appropriate reverence, and it should be very carefully wielded. So I agree with that. But also, some of it is just I've learned things about the world by looking at regulations that I never would have known. And I think there are people who follow the feed who have said quite frequently, well, I'll be honest, I didn't know that a teaser pig was a thing. I didn't know that that existed, and now I do. Maybe you didn't want to know.
Well, speaking of that, because we're going to have some fun with this. We're going to play a game. I'm going to open to a random page, and we're just going to have you like talk about the crimes in question.
Crime roulette.
It's like, all right, here we go. Oh, Prohibition, moonshine, and the IRS.
Oh, yeah.
Talk about some fun crimes involving prohibition and moonshine.
Yeah. So I love the labeling laws that came out of the Federal Alcohol Administration Act following prohibition, which was the labeling of beer and how you can't call beer full-time, old-time alcoholic strength, or you can't say it's extra strength beer, which is exactly the kind of beer that I would want to go buy, would be extra strength beer.
That may be why you can't say it.
Yeah, I guess that's right. But you also can't call beer pre-war strength beer. And I thought it was interesting because, I mean, I think we all know what war they're referring to, but you know, what war are you referring to? I mean, pre-Civil War beer?
No, it's pre-Grenada.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. War of the Oaken Bucket, I think there was one, right? The pre-War of the Oaken Bucket. But I like how puritanical the labeling laws are, and I like how so many of them remain on the books. Now, there's some Supreme Court precedent, you know, the Tam case and then a couple of others about obscene things that you might not be able to say. That's probably on shaky constitutional ground. But I still love how the government still says that you can't sell wine with a label that suggests it has intoxicating properties.
Right. It's got to be implicit.
Because I want to know before I buy it. This thing better have intoxicating properties.
All right. Talk to me about triangular margarine and loose margarine.
So this you're after my own heart here, because triangular margarine is one of my favorites. Because, you know, the war on butter, the war on margarine, it was such an amazing time in American jurisprudence, where the dairy lobby essentially said, whoa, 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 margarine is totally threatening our market share, and people seem to be fine with it. They can't tell the difference. So we're going to do a couple of things. At the state level, they got it to be a federal crime, or a state crime rather, to sell margarine if it was yellow. And they even got laws passed that said that the margarine had to be pink in order for it to be sold. And people were charged with those offenses. But when it came to triangular margarine, if you're a restaurateur and you allow people to come in and get individual servings, individual pats of margarine, federal law still to this day requires that they either be conspicuously labeled or triangular in shape. And to go to your question that you asked before, you say, have anybody ever been charged with these offenses? In my my home stomping grounds of Hartford, Connecticut, there was a guy named Joseph Trowaski. He was actually hauled out of his restaurant and arrested for selling square pats of margarine in his restaurant. So people have been charged.
Wow. Yeah. All right. Explain how you can commit crimes with wild donkeys. You actually have a nice graphic on this. Figure 216, wild donkey crimes. Walk us through a wild donkey crime.
Yeah. So, I mean, wild little donkeys, some people call them burros, but I like to refer to them as wild little donkeys. They are robustly protected under federal law, and they probably should be, because people were doing some pretty horrific things to them at one point. But you really can't mess with them. You can't commercially exploit one. You can't steal one off of federal land and use it as a rodeo donkey. So if you're looking for a rodeo donkey, you've got to go through sanctioned channels. You cannot just take one off of land. You also can't harass one from an airplane. So if you are a pilot and you decide you want to go harass some little donkeys, you can't do it. Not in the United States.
From an airplane.
From an airplane.
But can you do it from like a hang glider?
It's a good question. I think that it may say aircraft, so a hang glider may – I don't know if it's defined as an aircraft. You can't use a drone, that's for sure. If you go get your quadcopter, you can't do it.
A message to drunken predator, lay off the wild burros. What's the World War II nickel exception?
Oh, yeah. So the World War II nickel exception is this great provision in federal law because if you're going to leave the country with too many nickels in your pocket, you need a special license from the government. And I think it's about $25 worth of nickels, so that's too much. And if you leave the country with all those nickels, you can't violate the law if you use nickels that were minted essentially during World War II because they don't contain nickel. They contain other cheaper metals. But so it's – I think it's 1940s, 1944, 1945. If you have a nickel in that range, you can leave the country with as many of those as you want. But if you leave with $25 worth of the good stuff, the good nickels, which I hate all nickels personally. I think they're the worst coin. But if you leave with the good nickels, the government can prosecute you.
All right. So we're a national security law podcast, not a money laundering podcast.
Ooh.
And so we need to turn to the part of this book that deals with really serious national security crimes. So I want to just start by just asking you, what are the funniest national security crimes that our listeners didn't know you could commit?
Well, you can't give a terrorist a ride on a boat. That's actually a federal statute.
All right. So walk us through how, like, I mean, I would think if you did it knowing he was a terrorist,
sure,
intending, that would be covered by the material support law. Is it more specific than that?
Well, it's a different statute. First of all, it's not just the material
support
statute.
It's like giving the terrorist a ride on a boat statute.
Yeah, and I think you do. I think there is a knowingness requirement. I think you do have to knowingly transport them. But even if it's just a delightful boat ride, I mean, if it's just a delightful afternoon boat ride and this happens to be a terrorist that you know about and you're not actually trying to aid them in any terroristic activity, you're still committing a federal crime. And that's largely because federal law defines vessel extremely broadly. So I don't know how small you can get, but if you're riding around on the water with a terrorist in your dinghy, you could be indicted for that.
There's also a statute against entertaining a pirate.
Oh, yes.
What constitutes entertainment under the statute?
Well, I think actually the Crimes Act of 1790 uses the word entertain, and somewhere we lost the entertain verb, and now we have confederate or consult with. So if you know a pirate and he's got a consultancy here in Washington, I look, we're in the capital of consulting work. You got to ask if your consultant is a pirate because you could be committing a crime. But you can't write a letter to a pirate, all of those things. But yeah, back in the Crimes Act of 1790, it was a crime to entertain a pirate. Now that may mean let them stay at your house, but it may also just mean dancing for them. I don't know. Maybe doing a little bit of stand up. Who knows?
Right. It would put you in a difficult position.
Yeah, if I wanted to.
Because
yeah.
What if in the course of representing a pirate against, say, a charge of piracy, you were entertaining?
I'm glad you raised that because these are not the things I've noodled through, but it's making me a little more nervous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, we have on Lawfare spent some time on explosives law.
Oh, yeah.
In the past. I'd never known that there was a law against not reporting the width of a lost stick of dynamite before.
Yeah.
Talk to me about the law of lost dynamite.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's some people that have written some rules that I think maybe they need to go see a therapist because they have a complex or something. But yeah, you have to – if you lose a stick of dynamite, you have to call the ATF and report the length and diameter of the lost explosive if you know it. And you got to be accurate because as we know, 18 U.S.C. 1001, if you lie to them about the girth of your explosives, you could probably get into some trouble with the feds. And it's not enough to just call the feds and say, hey, I lost my dynamite again.
Right. I lost my 8-inch, 1¼-inch thick stick of dynamite.
Right.
So, all right. Eric Rudolph, when he was captured, he managed to get the death penalty dropped against him by disclosing the location of a very large cache of dynamite that he had buried, I believe, in a national forest. I leave aside whatever other crimes that
this
may
is
have.
Getting bad. Yeah.
So my question is, should they bring a separate case against him now for not disclosing the length and width of each of those sticks of dynamite? He disclosed the location. And this is a terrorist, you know, but how many counts? Like, could they get as many counts as there are sticks?
Probably it's per instance. Yeah, for sure. Now, what I would say is those don't sound like lost explosives to me. And so if he knew exactly where they were,
I don't know. They were kind of hidden.
They were hidden.
Actually may be missing an element of the offense.
Yeah, but there are other offenses. So he wasn't storing them in an appropriate explosives magazine. So there are other offenses there. In fact, even if you don't sweep your magazine or if you conduct repairs on your magazine without removing explosives from it, that's also a federal crime. Although that's more of a – like if you're doing welding in your explosives magazine, that's what we know as a self-enforcing statute.
I just want to say these regs sound pretty reasonable to me.
Sure. Oh, yeah. No, that one sounds very
like,
reasonable.
I think if you're being careless with dynamite, there's an argument for of all the loopy regs to attach criminal sanctions
to. You're such a stiff, you know. That is such an old school view, you know. As speaking on behalf of all millennials, we're very laissez-faire about our explosives, you know. And I'm looking forward to a world in which we're much more careless with our explosives. Well, but here's the issue. People from that live
those
through
words have never been said on the Lawfare podcast before.
Good. All right. Well, good. I'm glad.
Breaking new ground.
I will say anybody who
more
lives
bourbon.
I will say anybody who lived through the financial crisis of 2007 and 2008. Could probably also support this crime, which is that it's a federal crime to engage in bomb-backed lending. So you can't loan against stolen explosives. Now, I'm not sure that a lot of people are using stolen explosives as collateral for loans. And
it's a small part of the payday lending industry.
Yeah, I would think so. Congress hasn't – they've turned their attention to bomb-backed lending, but they haven't yet really gotten serious about payday lending,
right? But payday bomb-backed lending,
oh, yeah.
They've got it covered.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. So there are other than entertaining pirates, there are some awesome pirate laws and – some of them you can see how they kind of became like they once may have been useful or once may have been relevant. And some of them just seem like they were always a little nuts.
Right.
Talk to us about the criminal law of piracy.
So, I mean, look, I love the law of piracy because it harkens back to a sort of a historical era in federal law. And also it's one of the three crimes mentioned in the Constitution, right? So there's counterfeiting, treason, and piracy. And so Congress, the initial Congress, was extremely concerned about piracy and rightfully so. But, you know, I like the very classic pirate statutes like corresponding and confederating with pirates. There are other some really, really good ones such as this practice called moon cussing. And I don't get into that one necessarily as much in the book. But there's this thing called moon cussing where pirates used to set up false beacon lights on the shores and make boats crash into the shores so that they could plunder the ships. And that's explicitly prohibited under federal law.
When was the last time a case of moon cussing was actually prosecuted?
You know, it's actually very interesting. There's this guy named Dan Seavey, and he was a pirate who, interestingly, was not a coastal pirate. He was on the Great Lakes. And this is back when the Supreme Court actually had to determine that the high seas included the Great Lakes. They were big enough. They had sort of white caps on the waves. And so the Supreme Court determined that they counted as the high seas. And so Dan Seavey was this guy who was probably the first lake pirate that ever existed. He never was formally prosecuted under federal law, but he used to moon cuss ships on the shores of the Great Lakes. And I talk about it in the book. I could probably find the date, but it wasn't that long ago. I mean, the New York Times was around, and the New York Times reported on this great chase that Dan Seavey had with federal authorities. And so I think that was back in the 1800s.
All right. Stowaways. You know, airfares are so cheap now mm-hmm. that the incentive to do it seems de minimis. But stowaways?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, anybody who's flown out of gate 35X at Reagan, you know, you might discover that you can get on the JetBlue flight out of a different gate and not have to deal with 35X. So you might decide to stow away. Maybe you have a ticket and you decide to stow away on another airline. I would do it. But yeah, stowaways, you know, originally began as people on ships. They used to hide in barrels and things like that. There was an early stowaway who took the trip over from Spain in a barrel with a mastiff, a dog, the whole trip, which, I mean, that's pretty serious.
That is commitment.
But as recently as the last couple of years, there's a woman from Chicago, and she had successfully stowed away on something like a dozen flights. And she had hidden in the bathroom, just somehow gotten down the jet bridge onto planes. And so it remains a federal crime, of course. I mean, it's essentially stealing, right? But being
it's
a stowaway,
it's kind of a legit federal crime, given how much energy we spend to know who's in what seat and who's gotten even in the vicinity of the gates, right? The idea that you're on the wrong plane going somewhere intentionally defrauding the airline, it doesn't seem like something that the federal government would have nothing to say about, right?
No, I agree, and I think that it's a legit crime, but it does expose an area where Congress is sometimes more reactive than proactive, because there was a case, and I talk about it in the book, where a guy got on a plane and he was essentially the first plane stowaway. And the courts had to determine back then, well, does a plane count? Because the statute really seems to be speaking about boats. And so he got a free trip essentially from Hawaii to the United States on a plane, and they couldn't charge him because the statute didn't apply to planes.
So how long after that did it take?
Less than a year.
Less than a year. That's pretty good. That's back when Congress functioned.
That's right. And now they don't. So for example, you know, and that's one of the sort of more serious crime of day issues is Congress being so dysfunctional and gridlocked. A lot of times there are good faith needs for them to be reactive. And so they end up having to go through the administrative state because they're, you know, they can publish something in the Federal Register, go through the notice and comment period, and effectively change law. I don't think that that's necessarily consistent with the constitutional design, but in effect, it's one of the only ways that laws can get passed now. But that was an example of some people looking at a situation and they said, you know what? We should pass a law that makes it a crime to stow away on a plane, just like we should delay the impeachment proceedings of Richard Nixon so that we can vote on the Woodsy Owl bill.
All right. So let's talk about what you still can stow away on, because there are, boats and airplanes, we got some other options. Can you stow away on a bus?
I think
there's that whole baggage compartment.
I think you can stow away on a bus. Now, they may charge you under some state law, but I don't think that the feds can really get you, even though you're traveling Amtrak. There may be some rail offenses, but I don't think that there's a specific train stowaway statute.
Because there's got to be given the hoboing culture, there's got to be some law that says you can't sneak onto a interstate train.
They may end up totally doing it. I think you should give it a shot. We could use a test case. And maybe I just haven't come across the statute yet. But I don't know that there's specifically a rail theft statute. There may be.
So if listeners can get us a citation either on buses or on Amtrak or on freight trains, I think there's got to be a law on freight trains because that was a whole culture.
Yeah.
We want to know. Tweet those offenses at Crime A Day and at Benjamin Wittes, and we'll be sure to look them up and do very little with them.
No, I'll use them because it'll make my day that much easier. I'll have a crime.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. Yeah. I won't do much with it. Getting on a boat before it has docked.
Oh, yeah.
This is my favorite crime in the book. Mm-hmm. How did this come to be a crime and what does it cover?
So we talked about pirates a couple of minutes ago, and back during the piratical days of the United States, there was this practice of Shanghaiing sailors. And it was a time mostly on the Barbary Coast and in San Francisco where these people called crimps and sailor runners used to basically steal people off of ships. And people had been out to sea for so long, they hadn't seen a woman or they hadn't had a drink in a long time. And so these guys would scale the sides of ships that were just about to arrive at shore but hadn't yet arrived. And they would bring a bounty of things. They would bring whiskey, opium, pornography, and they would say, come with me, abandon this ship, and come to my boarding house, and we'll give you all of the women and drugs and booze that you want. And these guys were so desperate that they would get off the ship and go to these boarding houses and abandon their entire pay for the whole journey because they were so desperate for some, you know, substance and comfort, so to speak. And what would end up happening is they would be essentially taken into servitude by these boarding houses. And it was a pretty ugly scene. I mean, they would grab these guys off, drug them up, and put them in the boarding house. So Congress passed a law and they said, look, this is horrific and we're going to make it a crime to board a ship before it arrives. It's about to arrive but hasn't arrived yet. And that's almost exactly what the statute says. It says it's a crime for anybody without legal cause to board a ship that's about to arrive at shore but hasn't yet. Now, they all knew what they were talking about. Congress knew exactly the kind of harm that they were talking about. It was these sailor runners and crimps. And so they left the statute on the books for forever. Right?
So when was it passed?
So this is passed back in, you know, some turn of the century. So it's back in the 1800s, late 1700s or early 1800s, I think. And it gets passed in response to a bunch of these instances. It might be like 1830 or so that it gets passed. And so it sits on the books for 100 years after this inveigling of sailors ends. And then in 2005, some activists for Greenpeace catch wind of a ship with illegally harvested mahogany coming to the United States, and they get a good idea. They say, we're going to unfurl a banner that says, hey, President Bush, stop illegal mahogany. And so they get in a dinghy and they go out to this ship. And they get on board and they try to unfurl the banner, but they're unsuccessful and they get rejected and they go back to shore. The feds charge the Greenpeace activists with the early boarding statute. They're probably thinking they've committed some sort of disorderly conduct, misdemeanor, or something. They get charged with the federal crime of boarding a ship too early.
Which is effectively like a maritime trespassing statute, right?
In essence, but they've joined the company of people who used to steal sailors off of boats with opium and pornography.
I mean, that was their problem. They brought a banner. They brought no opium and no pornography.
That's right. And that's why I always advise clients, if you're going to trespass, always come bearing pornography. That's my advice, generally speaking. Now, this is not to your listeners but to my clients. But I think that, yeah, it's a problem because Congress had a specific harm in mind and they drafted an impermissibly vague statute, right? And they prosecuted people for this particular offense. And they said this is a matter of real federal concern. And what ended up happening was they left the statute alone thinking nobody was going to use it. And then some Greenpeace activists stumbled their way into a prosecution.
Speaking of your clients – how long have you been practicing criminal law?
So I've been practicing for 8 years in criminal defense, and I represent, you know, private clients, but I've also taken indigent defense cases appointed through the courts for the last 8 years.
So what is the most exotic or fantastical statute or fact pattern or regulatory violation any of your clients has ever actually been prosecuted for?
Yeah, so I will say that I have not gotten the exciting or good ones. I am familiar with a case that I wasn't responsible for, but I'm familiar with it through a colleague, which was actually an adulterated chicken offense. and interestingly, the federal judge at the time that the case was called said to the prosecutor, "What is this chicken bleep case doing in my courtroom?"
That's awesome. Because I once wrote a profile back when I was a Cub reporter of a guy whose favorite case he had ever prosecuted was a sword murder.
Oh.
And he said the reason he loved prosecuting that case was that he got to stand in front of the jury, hold the sword above his head and say, "This, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, is the murder weapon."
Mm-hmm.
And he said that feeling was such a rush that it was his favorite case he'd ever been involved in.
Yeah, I like to hold up swords during trial too, but they're never relevant to the case. there's a sort of an open ethics investigation about that. But there are a lot of bizarre crimes that probably never get prosecuted. I mean, during the course of investigations, the feds probably could charge a lot of folks. You'll probably remember this. This is also a national security matter, so this is germane. There was the gentleman Doug Hughes, who landed his gyrocopter on the Capitol lawn. And when he landed that gyrocopter, they initially charged him with violating, you know, airspace, right? But when they looked at his gyrocopter, he was actually a postman, but he had affixed the U.S. Postal Service Sonic Eagle logo to the tail fin, the rudder of his gyrocopter. And so they superseded. They charged him under a new document, new charging document, with falsely labeling a vehicle as a postal vehicle, which is its own
and
federal
statute.
And
which has a cool section in your early in the book, like chapter two or something.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, the federal crimes that you can commit with the mail is the entire first chapter. And yeah, I talk about Doug Hughes's charges now.
But you've never had a really cool exotic case.
I'm trying to think. I have had
some.
Do
you want one?
Well, I mean, I'd be really offended if anybody going forward goes to any other lawyer with one of these bizarre
crimes. All right.
This
is like, guys, listeners, let's get on this. At Crime A Day has never had a case under some, you know, bizarrely exotic statute a reasonable person would question the sanity of the legislative decision to pass. We need to fix this, people.
Well, I don't know if I would agree with that. I mean, also, although there's some of the more serious prosecutions that are going on at the borders, is that folks who come to the United States and don't disclose cash that they have with them, for example, all that cash can be sort of instantly seized by CBP if it's not been properly disclosed on forms that are required by CFR sites that nobody's ever read. And so this money gets seized and then the feds can say, hey, you know, by the way, we think that that's technically bulk cash smuggling. And so I've certainly handled matters like that. And what I think is sort of ludicrous is that the same penalty that applies to that. So, you know, you bring $20,000 worth of cash into the United States and don't declare it, and they say you're guilty of bulk cash smuggling, you could actually be exposed to the same penalty for leaving the country with more than $25 worth of nickels in your pocket.
It's all about the nickels.
It is.
If there's one thing you want people to take away from this book other than a certain humor, what is it?
So on the serious note, I will say that the thing that I hope people take away from it is that it's not wrong when people say that a huge swath of modern American life is regulated and is covered by federal law for the good or for the bad, right? And I'm not saying that law is inherently good or inherently bad. Certainly, I go through some of the crimes in this book that we'll all agree should absolutely be crimes because they're dangerous and harmful or idiotic, and then others that are just silly sounding. But I think that the core of it is that I think that it should be an uncontroversial position that if Congress is going to attach a criminal penalty to some piece of conduct, especially in a society where the law says that ignorance of the law is no excuse, I think that they need to do a better job at reining in the attachment of the criminal penalty. All these regulations can stay on the books, but if they have a criminal sanction attached to them, Congress should probably be a little more careful with that.
And it's probably worth a systematic effort to identify and put in one place the set of things that have criminal penalties attached to them so that at least you can, if you're contemplating getting on a ship before it's boarded
right.
or you know, serving square margarine, at least you can like go look up, is there a problem?
I think if you want to, I mean, I'm doing it for you, but I think if you want to, you should be able to sit down and open the criminal code and you should be able to read the criminal code. And you can't. In America, you can't sit down and read a single set of conduct that is criminally prohibited in the United States. And so that strikes me as wrong. You should be able to do that.
At Crime A Day, a.k.a. Mike Chase, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. 56 U.S.C. 2341 says you will go to prison if you do not share the Lawfare Podcast, tweet the Lawfare Podcast, talk about the Lawfare Podcast at dinner parties. 28 U.S.C. 413 says go to thelawfarestore.com or face a year imprisonment, a fine, or both to buy your merch. Anything else is in violation of federal law. 48 U.S.C. 431 says the audio engineer on this podcast can only be Michaela Fogel and Matt Kahn. Anyone else would be committing a federal offense. This is, by the way, Matt Kahn's last episode of the Lawfare podcast. In fact, recording this outro is the last thing he's going to do as an employee of the Brookings Institution. Of course, 26 U.S.C. 951A says that any music performed for the Lawfare podcast by anyone other than Sophia Yan is in violation of federal criminal law, and that nobody except Jen Patya Howell is allowed to produce or edit the Lawfare podcast. And last of all, if you do not rate the Lawfare podcast on whatever podcast distribution service you use, you may be in violation of 23 CFR 976 and 18 USC 423. And as always, thanks for listening.